Whether you're a pistachio purist who loves the experience of cracking them open, or you just love the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios is the perfect healthy snack when hunger strikes. I happen to love me my pistachios. I don't want to screw around with the nuts, so I love the no-shells pistachios. Anyway, there are a bunch of flavors to choose from, like honey roasted, smoky barbecue, jalapeno, lime, and more. Wonderful Pistachios is one of the highest protein nuts, and each ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Visit wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more.
I love fast cars, but there aren't a ton of high-performance EVs. They're certainly out here, there, but when I get a chance to get behind the wheel of one, I love it. And I was blown away by the Kia EV6 GT. When you get behind the wheel of the Kia, it is literally like being in a state-of-the-art rocket ship, but also comfortable. The thing goes from 0 to 60 in 3.4 seconds. It is the premium driving experience. And of course, it's an EV. So the climate thanks you. SiriusXM provides access to over 165 channels in the vehicle. Music, sports, news, comedy, yacht rock. Let's go. Little Steely Dan going in your Kia. Come on now. So check it out today. It is the all-electric Kia EV6 GT. I had a blast checking it out. Believe me, you should do it yourself via kia.com/EV6. To learn more, that is kia.com/EV6. Kia, movement that inspires. I felt like you were telling my story. Divorce, young, screwed. Yeah. It's really fucked you up. At least it fucked me up.
Yeah.
Went from Ohio to Malibu, culture shock. And then, yeah, I'm getting, this one is one I'm getting. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Literally. The very hilarious Paul Scheer is with us today. I always love when we have the comics. And by the way, calling him a comic is somehow debasing because he has an amazing book coming out. He's a producer. He's a director. But let me say this. When I have funny people, I love me some funny people. And this is one of the funniest. And I'm really looking forward to catching up with Paul Scheer.
This is it.
This is it, brother.
I mean, people are tuning in like the end of MASH.
By the way, which was apparently today. Did you know that?
I did not know that. Look at that. This is like the cosmic, the Repo Man plate of clams moment here. It's all come together.
It's all come together. However many, 45 years, whatever it was. I just read. By the way, here's my hot take. Never watched MASH. Never saw it.
Felt like my parents' show.
Did not like it.
Like, it felt depressing to me, even though it's like, you know, right? It didn't feel like my Different Strokes. It didn't feel like my Silver Spoons. I wanted laughter. Come on.
Well, that was part of the problem. There was laughter.
Where are
those people in the tent that are laughing?
I mean, it's interesting because it was a multicam laugh track in a single cam show. And honestly, it's
On location.
On location, yeah. With a very depressing theme song. I mean, that's the thing.
Oh,
I think that Suicide is Painless, opening. Oh. As a kid, I was like, I'm out.
And listen, not to be a horny young teenager, which I was.
Sure.
When I was watching it, but the opening shot of the female soldier running with her breast bouncing. it was like, I walked into a deli once. Uh-huh. And you know, like delis and dry cleaners always have like signed celebrity. Oh, yeah. And there was a still of that woman running.
Oh, my God.
Signed. And I thought that was one of the coolest.
I mean, that's a great get for a deli or a laundromat. Have you ever given a signed picture to one of those places? I've been asked by my laundromat to do it. I felt very honored. But then I felt the pressure like, which picture am I going to pick? Because I know it's not going to age well because the sun's going to hit it. And then, you know, in 25 years, they never take them down.
No, and they're so, it's like, there's something about the faded black and white headshot. In LA, do you ever go to, what's the pizza place I love so much?
Yes. I know that pizza place in like Eagle Rock, right?
Well, the one I'm talking about is actually in Beverly Hills, and it's Kathy Moriarty's ex-husband from Raging Bull. So there's all that vintage. It's
yes,
it's so great. It's my favorite. It's my
very
favorite
good pizza.
Favorite pizza, but there's a lot of like faded Scott Baio, like, you know, as 19-year-old, and
yes, I think you need to re-up. Like the way I would say is like if you give that, you have to go in every 5 or 10 years and just give a new picture because it's our responsibility to take away some of that. You know, I think we have to do it.
You don't have anxiety about what you write? I have way more anxiety about what I write, what the inscription is.
1,000,000%. I don't know how funny to be. Then I get too verbose and then it's too much writing. I have to really think about it before. Do you have a staple thing that you write when you sign something?
I did for years, but I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I realized that I'm basically almost 60, but I'm doing a lot of the stuff that I've been doing since I was 15, which is when I first started signing autographs. I was 15.
Right.
So I sign like a fucking 15-year-old, I realize.
Your signature gets caught in like an amber. Like it doesn't evolve. Like once you got it, you got it.
No. So my go-to for years was All My Love, Rob Lowe. But that feels very, from a 60-year-old, it's what it was. It feels like Tiger Beat. It feels like Bop Magazine.
But I have to say, like, you exude this really nice, like, hearing it from you doesn't feel creepy. I think as if you get that from a 16-year-old, you're like, oh my gosh, All My Love. But you hear it from you now, you're like, oh, this guy's a good dude, All My Love. Yes, of course, All My Love, of course. I think I need a catchphrase, like maybe just cheers.
Oh, that's really good. Because you know why? It's unisex.
Yeah.
It's like All My Love. I go, really? Is there All My Love? All My Love. Really?
Forget about my children. All my love is going to you, laundromat.
Yeah, it just seems so disingenuous now. But then you can't shorten it to love because then it's like, ooh, I don't know.
Too much. Yeah.
Way too much.
And you don't want to just make it your name. You want to show like, oh, we had some sort of connection.
Yes.
But it's hard. You want to be original. You have books. I imagine you did book signings.
Yes.
In doing book signings, did you feel pressure?
No.
No.
In book signings, because, you know, you're getting through, there's so many to be done and you want to make sure everybody who's there gets one.
Right.
So that was what I used to make me feel better about just signing my name.
Just got the moment. You got the moment and you're in. You don't have to put any personalization. I get freaked out about names. Even if you tell me like, Rob Lowe is an easy name for me to remember. Like, and
two B's? It's Rob with two B's, dude.
Oh, Rob with two B's. That's tricky.
And it's L apostrophe O-W-E.
I'm like, please write it down and I will copy it exactly. But if I'm forced to do a spelling assignment down there, it would be as hard as doing math. I can't do it. It's too much pressure. I'm trying to make something happen here.
I can't. Spelling and math. Listen, for everybody out there who doesn't spell well, I was able to write, and as you were, bestseller authors, we don't know how to spell.
No. I mean, thank God for an editor. Thank God for grammar check. I mean, you need it. Look, I think if you are not a good speller or good at math, chances are you'll probably become some sort of actor, somebody in this business, because it's the only time you don't really need to use it.
It's really true. And spelling has nothing to do with writing. Literally nothing.
I've read your books, but I know that you had a very interesting youth, but did you ever do a spelling bee when you were like before 15?
Insane child. I was a pleasure to have in class. I was.
Yes,
I was sat in the front row, raised my hand. I was a good little boy and I was very good at a very limited amount of academics. Very good.
Okay.
Somebody once described, I got tested once and they said,
okay,
your mind is like a Ferrari trying to tow an anvil.
that's a beautiful way of looking at things, right? I mean, because I feel like I had that as well. It's like, I'm going so fast. And it's like, how do you slow down? I would much prefer like a conversation over a test. Tests were hard. I remember, I do have this memory of me doing a spelling bee where the word, it was first round, easy. Everyone stays up on the first round. It was an inter-school spelling bee. It was, you know, nothing major, but, and I was so cocky. I was like, got this. Got it wrong.
Oh, no.
Just got it wrong immediately. And I did it again just recently. I was on Wheel of Fortune, a dream come true. And there was a word up there, and it was like thrilling water slides. But I said, thrilling water slide. And I was like, no. Like, it was, I knew it, but I just, like, there's sometimes that small disconnect. I was right there and missed it by a letter.
So you just made me think of something that I've never told this story ever, which is, I feel like I've worked through every story 1,000 times, but I was a little kid in school, spelling bees, all that stuff. I participated in almost everything, but anything having to do with spelling and math. And one day they came, I was probably I'm in the second grade, probably. Okay. And they go, there's a school talent show. And I was like, oh yes, finally. Right. It's not math. It's not spelling. I wasn't good at sports when I was young.
Yeah.
Talent show. I'm so in. And then there was an audition, right? After school, you go and think. And I got there and I guess I really didn't know what a talent show was. I'd never seen one.
Yeah.
And I thought you'd walk in and they'd have categories. I don't know what I don't know what the fuck I was thinking.
You could align yourself with something.
Yes, I'm going to go over to the tent over here where people are sewing buttons, or I'll go over here where like this is like jokes, or over here these guys are doing trivia. I want to be in. I had no idea, and they go, "Okay, Rob Lowe."
Oh God.
I've never told this. My heart right now, I'm having such anxiety right now. So. And I'll never forget being in a circle of those little tiny chairs that little kids sat in. And I had to go, I don't know what I'm going to do, what my talent is. I know I've got some talent, but I don't know anything. So the best thing that I could do was I had recently done like a pantomime class at some local kids' theater.
Okay.
So this is the most cringy story in the history. I just started like pantomiming stuff. With no point, purpose, no beginning, middle, or end, nothing. And finally, whoever was running it just took some pity on me, said, "Hey, why don't you sit down?" And, you know, and then I remember running away.
All right. Well, Rob, I can match you a little bit and say that I'm a little older in this moment, and I'm just starting to audition for commercials and stuff like this, right? I'm in New York City, and I'm older. So I'm in probably in my early 20s. And I had watched this documentary about, I think it was about Robin Williams, and they had the producers of Happy Days on the show. And they said, you know, Robin Williams, he was unlike anybody else. When he came in, he did his scene for Mork on Happy Days, which was on his head. And we couldn't get him out of our head. We're like, oh my God, what a choice. He did it on his head because Mork, of course, wouldn't know how to sit. He would sit on his head. So I don't take the lesson from that, which is just to be interesting. I take the literal lesson, which is do something on your head.
Amazing.
So I go in for this Skittles commercial.
Amazing.
And there's a chair, and I'm going to sit in this, but the chair has wheels on it. And I've never practiced getting on my head. I don't know how to get on my head, but I'm like, I'm going to get on my head for a Skittles commercial on a rolly chair. And I'm trying to mount it. And picture going on your head on a roller chair. I'm wrestling with this chair for far too long for like a two-line Skittles commercial. And the casting director's like, you know what? Why don't you just, you don't even need the chair. And now I'm sweating because now I'm like, I thought I had it. Skittles is fun and crazy. And I'm like, and it was just the most soul-crushing moment of like, I'm trying to be different and I can't. And when the room feels that way, you know, it's like, thank God for that casting director to be like, let's stop that. And let's move forward. But I remember that moment.
The
so clearly,
shame of it all.
Where else can you go surfing and skiing in the same day? Or check out a world-class art museum and camp out under a brilliant night sky same day? Or hike through the redwoods and get a luxury spa treatment? There's only one answer: California. No matter where you go across this state, you will find a way to play. I love California. And I have not yet surfed and skied in the same day, although I do both. So that is on my bucket list. It's the most beautiful place in the world. Discover why California is the ultimate playground. Head to visitcalifornia.com to start planning your trip today. Hey, listeners. Ever have trouble getting someone on the phone when you have a question about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day, or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card. So I came home to a little gift in my bathroom the other day from our friends at Harry's. To get what you want, you have to challenge the status quo and blaze your own trail. You know who challenged the status quo? Harry's. They saw customers getting ripped off by questionable products in the shaving industry and decided they had something better to offer. So instead of charging the same old ridiculous prices, Harry's found a way to make their beautifully designed razors, and they are beautiful, for a fraction of the price of the other big brands. Exceptional products, honest prices. That's Harry's. They have the highest customer satisfaction in shaving history and a no-risk trial. Don't like your shave? No worries. It's on them. Convenient subscription options that you can cancel at any time. And Harry's also has other self-care products that meet the same quality standards as their razors. Richly lathering, skin-softening body wash in scents like redwood, wildland, and stone. And an extra high-quality, amazing-smelling deodorant for just $5. I love their stuff. I'm so impressed by Harry's products. All of it. It's all good. Don't settle for the status quo. Blaze your own trail with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/rob. That's harrys.com/rob for a $3 trial set.
We do put ourselves in these moments where you just, you eat it. You eat it. And I mean, I eat it as a dad. I eat it as an actor, you know, and these are these moments where you just like, oof, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. Yeah. I coached my son's rec league basketball team, and they were like, the kids were like, why don't you shoot and we'll try to, you know, defend. And I was like, great. And I put up a shot that was so atrociously bad. Like, that was like, I've never seen basketball. Mm. I didn't know what I was holding. I didn't even know where the hoop was. And the kid on my team was like, were you trying to make it that bad? And of course, I was like, yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. Of course, I'll make it bad. I can shoot better than that.
I want to show you what not to do.
It's like those moments are like, oh, especially when you get called out by a kid. When a kid sees exactly what you're doing wrong, and it's the worst.
It's not good. I wish that there was, maybe we'll start this. You and I will do the podcast of this together, where it's actors' most embarrassing audition stories.
Oh.
How sick would that be? Or, by the way, or boldest, most successful, the one I always hear about that I'm kind of obsessed with, and I know eventually I'll meet him and I'll ask him, is Silence of the Lambs, one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, love
it. All time. Ted Levine plays Buffalo Bill.
Yeah.
Have you heard this story?
No, I haven't, and I'm excited.
I heard he came in to audition for Buffalo Bill. He puts the lotion on its butt, whatever the fuck it, right? Amazing. Yeah. And the thank you. And he goes, you know, I did have one other instinct. They're like, oh, by all means. Walks out, comes back in. He's nude and he's tucked his penis
between
his legs and does the famous...
That dance.
The famous dance.
See, I would never have the courage to do that.
If that's true, it's the greatest audition story ever.
Oh my God. I mean, that really does kick it up a notch. I know that you produce stuff. I've been on the other side of, I've directed and I've produced and I've been on the other side and watching people audition. I think you learn the most about auditioning by watching people because you realize, and I think this is something I was trying to tell people, like, very rarely are there bad auditions. It's just like, are you right for it or are you not right for it? Sometimes things stick out. Sometimes things fit in perfectly. Like it's no rhyme or reason. It actually makes you feel better in auditioning, right? You either got it or you don't. So I was auditioning kids, and auditioning kids is a whole other thing because, you know, they're young, they're fragile. You want to have fun with them. And there's a sketch for Human Giant, which is a sketch comedy show I did with Aziz Ansari and Rob Hubel.
Two of my favorites.
The best. And directed by Jason Wallner. And the sketch was, I'm this billionaire businessman who is driving through a small town. I stop to get some lemonade. And it's so good that I basically buy this girl's lemonade and like make her into like a sweatshop. I'm making her make like so much. And I'm making such profit off of her thing. And at one point, she's not making enough lemonade. So I go back and visit her lemonade stand and I grab her dog and I break its neck and I go, keep up the production. You know, it's so dark and weird. And so, keep up, you know, so yeah. we're auditioning that scene and and we're like, so when we do that, we want you to, you know, we really want to feel you sad. Like I just killed your dog and you know that, you know, we're kind of setting up the premise just to see if she can play these levels.
Yeah, sure.
And she's like, okay, well, let me take a second. She walks out and we do a couple more auditions. She comes back and she's ready. We start the scene within the first line, tears pouring down her face. She's uncontrollably crying. And we're like, oh, stop. Are you okay? Okay. And she's like, I just was thinking about my real dog and my real dog just died. And my dad told me to think about when we had to put him down. And I was like, oh no. Like it's this moment of this girl going through this intense trauma for this dumb comedy sketch. And we're like, oh, it's okay. It's okay. And then we didn't cast her.
Yes. And now she cries over that.
Yeah. You know, look, she couldn't keep it together. And that's it. That was a hard lesson learned for that 6-year-old.
I remember auditioning for Robert Redford, one of my heroes. A Quiz Show was the name of the movie.
Great
and
movie.
This was very, very, so long ago that it was an almost unheard of request that he had that everybody go on tape and not be in person. Like,
oh, wow.
Like now that's what everybody does. But then it was like unheard of and like, how dare he? But he's Robert Redford and whatever. And I now realize why I'm super, super uncomfortable in auditions for other actors. Like when I'm the producer, I hate it. I hate it. I'd rather be auditioning myself.
Right. Cause it's like you want, cause it also feels like they're trying to, and in these moments, it's like connect with you, but then you're like, it's a tricky position. It's very hard. You've been on both sides. That's very hard.
By the way, your background is amazing. It looks like the set of, it looks like the, and I know we're not, nobody can see it, but trust me, it looks like Darren Stevens' psychiatrist.
Yeah, I'm in a Bewitched library.
In a Bewitched psychiatrist library. Can we go back to MASH for a minute? Why the song? Can you imagine playing that today? Where you walk
The notes that you would get on that.
I was so depressed, by that show.
I felt like it was the cue for me to walk out of the room. I spent a lot of time at my grandparents' house growing up. And when that came on, I was like, all right, I'm out. I'll see you in 25 minutes.
Why did people love that show so much?
It was really this cultural phenomenon. And MASH to me, I love Robert Altman. And I saw the movie and I saw the TV show. And neither of them really appealed to me. Like I just, it mm-hmm. was just something else. I think that it was just over my head, or it just didn't fit in my...
Now here's the, but on the other hand, I'm just going to bet that you were a Hogan's Heroes fan.
Oh, well, that's funny. I mean, and that seems to me an older show. Like, I would love watching it because it's sillier. It's fun. It's army. It's good.
Well, it's a Nazi death camp, but yeah.
Well, sure. Right. I mean, by the way, that is always to me amazing. The best part of this. That was a sick. Could you imagine pitching? I mean, I would actually like to see that sitcom now, but like you could never get away with that. Like, it'll be a fun place for some jokes and ensemble comedy in a Nazi death camp. Oh, great. Let's go for it.
It's unbelievable. And based on a movie that was...
Of course.
Stalag 17, I guess, was the movie it was based on.
Not a comedy.
Not a comedy.
Yeah, not at all. I love that idea, too, to be like, we got this great drama. Let's just bring it in here and like, let's just find the fun of it. Let's just get in there.
Do you know what I found recently? I spent too much time on YouTube going down wormholes, but I saw the alternative opening to Gilligan's Island.
Whoa. Now that was a show I was obsessed with. Wait, now what is that like?
It's insane. First of all, they shot an entire pilot and scrapped it.
Okay. So different casting or different, some are the same and some of the guy?
Some the same, some not. But the song, and I wish I could remember it, is amazingly bad. Like, it's not the famous song that we know.
Yeah.
But it's like sort of Popeye the Sailor Man vibes, and it's very specific about the journey, like 15 leagues and 75. It's really, it's so bizarre.
I love it. It's such a tricky thing, right? Because I don't know if these songs are good or bad, but they live within me. I've been listening to Barbara Streisand's book.
Oh, bro. Okay.
I mean, it's 48 hours.
First of all, Barbara is a longtime friend. First of all. So there will be no Barbara hate on this podcast. Oh,
there's not a single ounce of Barbara hate. It is a full-on celebration. I am savoring
every
hour. I mean, I mentioned that it's 48 hours because I was like, wow, 48 hours. But I just was listening to this part last night, and it's great to hear her talk about it because I feel like you're sitting in a room with her. She's telling it very casually.
Yes. How about how slow and deliberate she is?
Oh, so it's beautiful. As a fan, I love it.
Yeah.
But what I was so blown away by was she was talking about, and this all brings it back together here, working with Robert Redford on The Way We Were and creating that song Memories.
Yes.
And how the original song was too downbeat. And she's like, no, you can't be that. And she really walks you through the creation of that song. And then she adds this like little bow at the end. She's like, and then as we're working on the song, I go, what if Memories is the first word of the song? And she's like, and it was like, it was just a great way to see like how you saw the song in three versions, this classic song that everyone knows the melody of, and how they really workshopped every little bit of it. I was so impressed by that and so kind of blown away because she's really, I mean, she's fascinating on so many levels.
Oh, yeah.
But that was really, that kind of just blew me away just to see that her knowledge of that and like kind of picking out what the theme of that song was. And, you know, and I just called it Memories, but it's not Memories. I think it's The Way We Were.
Yeah.
But I love that, like, one thing can just go wrong or so right. And there you go. You get Gilligan's Island, the one that we love, sit back, right back, and you hear a tale you know, 77 fathoms and, you know, 35 nautical knots.
Off of Port Hueneme. the other thing about Gilligan's Island is, and you know this, you get on a TV show and maybe you're in the ensemble and the show becomes a hit. So you go back and you ask for more money and then you ask to be in the song.
Well, yeah, the song. I mean,
because,
the song is
because
the way to go.
The original is the movie star and the rest, two more people.
Oh, wow.
And the rest, there's two more people. It doesn't take much. And indeed, in the next season, the professor and Marianne.
That's
but the best
the way
is
to go.
The movie star and the rest.
And the rest is hilarious because there's only two more.
Why can't we just add more?
Just add their names. It's not like Lost. There's not 30 more people. No. It's two.
Transform your bathroom cleaning with Wet and Forget weekly shower cleaner. You just spray today and rinse tomorrow for a no-scrub clean. With over 33,000 five-star reviews, this is your once-a-week solution to keeping your tub and shower surfaces sparkling clean. Available at Amazon, Lowe's, Menards, Home Depot, and Ace Hardware. Join thousands who've switched to an easier clean. Get your Wet and Forget weekly shower cleaner today and make your bathroom sparkle with zero scrubbing.
The weather is getting warmer. It's time to ditch the jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. But there's no need to waste money on clothes that only last one season. With Quince, now you can get high-quality pieces that never go out of style. You'll be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts for $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering with the top factories, Quince cuts out the middleman and passes the savings directly on to you. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. My producer recently made an order for Quince, and here's what he had to say.
I'm really excited to revamp my closet with Quince. I cannot wait for my items to arrive from Quince. You know, I'm a sweater guy. I was looking at that burgundy cashmere crew neck. I love the blue chore jacket. Maybe I'll throw some joggers in there.
So upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/rob for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/rob to get free shipping and 360-day returns. quince.com/rob.
Vacations are always good. Sometimes they're even great. And Celebrity Cruises is about to ruin all of that. Because once you explore with us, you'll never want a vacation any other way. And with new quick Caribbean escapes, you'll never want a weekend any other way either. Celebrity Cruises. Nothing comes close. Visit celebrity.com, call 1-800-CELEBRITY, or contact your travel advisor. Ships Registry, Malta and Ecuador.
Were you in L.A. early enough back in the day to go to Alan Hale's Lobster Barrel on La Cienega Boulevard?
No. I'm a New Yorker, and now that you say it, I feel a deep sense of regret of not being able to go there.
Alan Hale's Lobster Barrel.
Okay, so is this a situation where Alan Hale is, this is the skipper from Gilligan's Island?
Yes.
Is he around? Is he at
greeter.
If you go to Pump, you might see Lisa Vanderpump, you know, but
yes.
Would you see Alan Hale just sitting at the bar shaking hands?
I was too young. I was taking the bus into my little auditions, but I would pass it all the time, wondering if I could see the skipper if I went in.
Yeah.
And then in Beverly Hills at this time was Carol O'Connor's Ginger Man.
Oh, wow. You see,
why don't TV stars do that anymore?
Well, I live right down the block from Dinah's Fried Chicken, Dinah Shore's Fried Chicken.
Wait a minute. And Dinah's Fried Chicken is Dinah Shore's Fried Chicken?
I thought it was, right? Am I wrong about this?
No, I think you're right because it's her signature now that I know it, which comes back to autographs, which comes back to the fact that I always thought, really? Dinah, it's a D, a line, and an H.
There it is. I mean, I've always envisioned Dinah Shore being there. Yeah. I'm looking it up right now and make sure. Opened in 1967.
It's got to be.
And let's say, and you know what? I live in a world where sometimes I'm like, I don't want to know if I'm wrong because it's enough. It seems funny enough to say it is right.
Oh, 100%. Okay. So if we right now could change the world. Mm-hmm. What celebrity's restaurant would we want to go to?
This is interesting. What would make us the happiest, right? I'm trying to think,
Leonardo DiCaprio's falafels.
I like that. I mean, you know, I just saw Quentin Tarantino also down the block from me just opened Coffee's Coffee, which is like Pam Grier, like it's a Pam Grier themed,
yeah,
right, yeah, coffee shop. I like that. I like something that has a little bit of that, like that pizzazz. Like you'll see them, like you know, the, there may be this thing, like they might be hanging out there. Like I feel like, you know, oftentimes it's a steakhouse, but I think we could do something. You're right, like a something that could be a little bit more fun.
We could do
like.
Amy Poehler's, it would be Amy Poehler's Waffle House.
I mean, sure. Well, I think you were right at the first time. Poehler's Pancakes.
Poehler's Pancakes.
I mean, that's, you know, that's going to bring you in. And I think that, yeah, I think you need to have something that's more general. No steak, no lobster. We need to go breakfast. But yeah, that's where it's the opening of all, you know, you always going to get good pancakes there. It's like Dupar's.
My brother and I always laugh about this. Our grandpa, who was like our second father, was a restaurateur in Ohio. And okay. He ran a place called The Spot Restaurant. Still exists. It's a historical landmark now in Sydney, Ohio. He ran it for 65 years or something. Mm-hmm. And he famously turned down his best buddy's offer to franchise his best buddy's hamburger stand that became Wendy's.
Oh, wow. What did he not like about it? Did he ever say why?
Who knows? But he was hell-bent on making a franchise with his high school classmate, Phyllis Diller's Chili.
Oh, my gosh.
When you think of Phyllis Diller, I don't know about you, but I go, oh, I wonder if she makes really good chili.
Yeah, Phyllis Diller and chili don't work. If you said Paul Newman's chili, like I buy Paul Newman made some good chili. Like Phyllis Diller doesn't feel like, oh, I got some good chili for you.
I'm not sure you want to, I don't know what you want. I don't know what you want from Phyllis Diller. Really?
Well, let me tell you this. This is, you know, again, we're kind of finding these circles. I was on tour. I was touring with this comedy group back when I was in college. And one of the people in my group was a big fan of MASH, and we were in Toledo, Ohio, and he was like, we have to go to Tony Paco's because Tony Paco's is what Klinger liked on MASH. And it was like this hot dog place in Toledo. He's like, oh, I can't wait to go back to Tony Paco's or what. Yeah, I don't even know. It's like, but we went to Tony Paco's, there's huge pictures of Jamie Farr up on the wall eating hot dogs. That's and we're right. Like, we gotta go to this.
That's like the, my other obsession is like going to places that are appeared in pop culture and sampling for yourself. So for example, I was in London. Mm-hmm. It was raining. I went to Soho. I went to Leho Fook's and I got a big dish of beef chow mein. Werewolves
of
London.
That's perfect. Now I know this name, but I'm trying to figure out what it's from, though, right?
Werewolves of London.
Oh, right.
Looking for a place called Leho Fook's. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein. Ah, ooh, werewolves.
Now, how many people are coming in there and doing it? Did they feel like, did you get like a look when you ordered it?
It's on the menu, like
okay,
beef chow mein, werewolves of London.
Now, does Warren Zevon get to eat there for free? Yeah,
for
the rest
life,
of his
you'd
life?
Think.
You gotta go there. And I love visiting those places, and you want so much from them because you feel like this connection. You know, it's like I did this show for 7 years called The League, and it's about fantasy football.
I loved The League.
Oh,
like, I'm a huge League fan.
Oh, that's awesome to hear.
Where can we watch it now?
Gosh, I wonder. Maybe on Hulu? It sometimes goes on and sometimes comes off.
Yeah.
You know, I never quite know, but people are finding it again and again. And we shot that show in LA, but we did all of our exteriors, which we were never in Chicago. And I can't tell you, to this day, I get dozens of like DMs of people sitting in the bar that we sat at that it was here in downtown Los Angeles. That looks nothing like the place that everyone goes to, going like, we're having a drink for the league. It's like, but it's such a funny thing. It's like, well, yeah, you're having a drink in the interior of the place. You could go to downtown LA and recreate it way better than this place. But people, it's such a fun, it seems like a pilgrimage that people go to this bar to have it. And we once went in as a group, and it was one of the best homecomings we could have possibly had. It's a high-end bar that we use the exterior of Gibson's. And, you know, it's not what we were just like trash people, you know, we were not in there for high-end stuff. So I think people go in there, like, it's a sports bar. And it's like, whoa, everyone's in a suit and tie in here.
You're like, no. Like, this is going to set me back a lot more than I thought, my pilgrimage.
Oh, yeah.
For the league.
The beer is going to cost you $15.
The league was ahead of its time, for sure.
We had such a fun time doing it. You know, I don't know how you feel about this. You've been on so many successful shows. We did that show for 7 years. They asked us to come back for an eighth season. And as a cast, we said no. We were at the height of our ratings. And there was a part of us, and it's interesting, we're all interesting creators, whether it's Nick Kroll or Mark Duplass and John Lajoie. We all come from this background. Like, we didn't want to overstay our welcome. And I feel like, you know, we wanted to make it special. I don't know if that's a good choice or a bad choice. I've done that a few times in my career, like just called an out. We did 4 seasons. We did 3 seasons. Let's go. Let's move on. I know that you've had similar things too. It's like, yeah, do you like, I mean, in retrospect, when you look back on it, there may be like moments where like, I wish I would have stayed on there for one more season. Or do you go like, no, it was good. It's good to continue to move.
I think they all, one way or the other, whether it's the cast deciding they're done or the network deciding they're done, they kind of have, other than canceling something that's clearly working, which I had happen, they kind of, the natural time of death like reveals itself.
Right.
You just know, particularly for something like the league, where it's so, I mean, it's so focused on that ensemble and that vibe and that sort of magic chemistry.
Well, it was so interesting because when we were doing Human Giant, we got picked up for a third season, but Aziz got Parks and Rec right at the same time. And we were faced with this choice. Do we slot Aziz in whenever we could? You know, like, because Greg Daniels and Mike were really awesome. The creators of the show were like, hey, whenever we're not using him, he can continue to do the show. But we also knew that show was such, it was all of our voices coming together. It was all of us working together that if we were to maybe lose one of those voices, it wouldn't be as good. And, you know, so I'd rather go out feeling like, oh, we did it the right way. We may have ended it a year too early or 2 years too early, but it's better. Sometimes it's like just better to get out while the getting's good. It's like leaving a party.
Yes.
Leave at the height. You never want to, you know, and I feel that way about movies. Get out, but don't make me go, oh, I wish it was a little shorter. Just go, I wish it was a little longer. Wanting more is a good thing. But it quickly drops to the other side of it's too long. It went on too for you.
It's like in an instant.
Yeah, it really is like a very... It's a fascinating thing, and you can see it, like, you know, you can see it in the fatigue of everybody there. But we had so much fun doing the league, and I think what was so great about that show was there were no scripts, so we got to bring ourselves to these characters, and we had these outlines, kind of like Curb, and they were really well crafted, and we would put these scenes together and kind of refine them. You know, it wasn't just like one take and done, but I think that kept it really fresh for us. It was like, oh, we can say things differently. We can do things. We can add our own elements to this character. Something that I think you get on a written show once the writers get to know you or once you feel familiar. But that was one of the best benefits of that.
I never realized that it was in the Curb model where it was very much improv. I never knew that.
Jeff Schaefer, our creator, was Berg Schaefer Mandel. Were three of like Seinfeld's top writers. And when Larry David left, they took over Seinfeld. And then when Larry David started Curb, they started Curb with him. And then subsequently they went off and Dave Mandel went to go run Veep after Armando left. And Berg went to go run Silicon Valley and Barry. And Jeff Schaefer went to go to the league and Dave on FX and still continues to do Curb.
That's the Hall of Fame of comedy writer, showrunners, producers.
And the nicest guys and so completely different. Like I've never worked with all three of them together. I've only worked with them separately. And I kind of like, I can see the Voltron of them together as one, but they all are independently just really interesting people.
Tell me, how are you liking the podcast world? I mean, you're you've got, how many do you have? I can't keep up.
I have two podcasts, and I started this back when people would say, well, what's a podcast? And you'd go, so if you go in the app store, you can download this app called Podcasts, and then you can listen. Like, I was trying to explain people, like, go on a website, you hear a player. You know, so we started it so long ago, this show, How Did This Get Made, with myself, Jason Mantzoukas, who I know you know, and June Diane Raphael. And it was just us talking about bad movies, fun, bad movies. And we come at it from the point of view of, we are fans of movies. We are actors, we're writers, we're directors. We know how hard it is. I've been in bad movies. It never was intended to be a bad movie. Right. I always describe it as, it's the conversation that you have at a diner after you see a movie. It's that group conversation. So we did that for a bit. And then I felt like I was watching too many bad movies. And I partnered up with my friend, Amy Nicholson, who is a New York Times film critic. And we started watching supposedly the best of the best, the AFI top 100 list. And that's kind of evolved into, now we're kind of going all over the place trying to find, like, what are these great movies? Are they just great in our mind, or are they actually really good? And, you know, kind of looking at things a little bit deeper.
Okay, so the AFI top 100 list, give me, like MASH, we always keep circling back to our theme here that we've discovered. What's your hot take on movies you're supposed to love that you don't get? Because I have a couple of them.
Oh, I am right with you. I think that in watching all those movies, it feels like the voters were somehow very influenced by Westerns and Vietnam, right? Because that there's an abundance of those types of films on the list. And they're of varying degrees of success, you know. But I felt like a lot of these movies, you know, they felt right for the moment, but they're not necessarily, or you say, oh yes, that movie is fantastic. I'm going to look right now and tell you some of the, we kicked a bunch of movies off the AFI list. Like, that was like at the end of it, we're like, all right, let's get rid of it. It doesn't belong on the list anymore. Let's make some more room, because, you know, it's an interesting list in the sense that there's no Black directors on the list at all. Wow. No female directors on the list at all. And so you have a certain energy that's on there, you know, that you're just like, I personally, and this is one that I think a lot of people love, and people I'm sure will be screaming at me if I say it, but I did not like The Searchers. I watched The Searchers. The Searchers.
Do you know what movie I've been sitting here about to say?
Yeah.
The Searchers.
Look at this. See, we're connected here. I love it. It's an interesting, it's like, yeah, it's good.
It's fine.
Get it.
It's like,
fine.
But people talk about it like it's The Godfather.
And I watched, and I went in with that idea, and like, I was like, okay. Yeah, okay, it's fine. And I think maybe it's because the people who voted on it were seeing John Wayne do something that they hadn't seen. So that kind of stands out maybe as something different.
Right.
But it really doesn't, it doesn't really.
I'd rather have Clint Eastwood doing something he hadn't done and The Unforgiven in that slot.
I love The Unforgiven. It's such a great thing. There's a great story. We had, on our Unforgiven episode, we had one of the actors on, and I'm going to forget his name, a great actor. And he told us, like, working with Clint was really interesting because he came to him and he said, you know, Clint, so I'm thinking for my character. And he goes, no. And he's like, I don't want to hear it. He's like, what do you mean? He's like, my job is to direct. Your job is to act. I'm not going to get in the way of that. He's like, you do your thing, I'll do my thing. And I thought that was such an interesting way of directing. It seems scary too, because it's like, okay, does he like it? Does he not like it? I don't know. You know, I don't know if you've ever worked with him, but it seems very, it's daunting.
I know him. And I have very close friends who've worked with him, and they all sort of share the same. My favorite most recent Clint story was I said to Bradley Cooper, I said, can you tell me about the fake baby in American Sniper? Yeah. The fake baby, right? It's amazing.
Huge.
So American Sniper, I love, and I love Bradley Cooper. I think he's one of the best actors we have, and he's spectacular in it. But there's a scene where he's got a baby in his arm, and it's fake.
Oh, it's comically fake, like independent movie fake baby.
And so I said, let me guess how it happened. It's, you know, as you know, when we shoot with real babies, you have to have two.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just guess. One was sick on the day and couldn't even make it to the set. The other one you work with and is crying. And Clint just goes as Clint has wont to do. Just bring in the puppet. And and Bradley stops me right there and he goes, no, Rob, there was nothing but a puppet.
Wow.
I said, wait.
That was sick.
Wait, it's a scene with a baby? You never had a baby? He goes, nope. And he
didn't want to be bothered with it.
And there's a scene in it, which I love, where you can see, absolutely see Bradley manipulating the arm to make it look like it's a real baby. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, yeah. And I said, what about that? He goes, well, I did it because I thought they would never be able to use it.
Right.
And it's in the movie.
Oh my God. You know, it's so funny because I'm sure, you know, Clint Eastwood seems like a guy who cares about what he's doing, but also wants to get it done, right? Why are we wasting time on this baby? We're going to waste hours on this stupid baby.
And the other thing is, he'll say that, which he's right, and go, if they're looking at the fake baby, we're in a world of trouble.
Well, and
he's right.
I think that's
right.
So true, right? Because it's like, when your eye starts to wander, it means you're not emotionally invested in what's going on. And I imagine that people who watch that movie didn't feel it in the moment as much as they felt it post the moment, right? Because you see pictures online and you start talking about it, it becomes a thing. But in that moment, it's just like, yeah, you're caught up in the action of it. You know, it is interesting. I always think about the story that you tell, I think it was in your first book, about crying on camera. And I have heard like a lot of stuff with Clint Eastwood, like, when you're doing these emotional takes, it's one and done the same way. It's like, let's move, let's go. Like, you got to hit it.
Right.
I think Hilary Swank was talking about that.
Yep.
And I always think about, and you taught me an important lesson. I always ask about this too. Like, where is the camera? Because it was in The Outsiders, right? Where you're like, you go for it. And it's a wide.
I brought it, and then it was a wide, and then another wide, and then an over the shoulder, and a wide, and 4 hours of me weeping. They get to my close up, and I'm dehydrated. There's nothing there. It's over. The most so painful. It's as painful as the phony talent show in second grade story, where I'm like, all eyes are on me, and there's nothing more to do.
Yeah, you've done it. It's like whenever I direct anything, I do try to let actors know, like, just know it's here. It's at this point. Because I don't think that people, sometimes you'll just be in these moments where they don't tell you, they assume. And they probably are like, oh my gosh, Rob is, you know, we're not going to get in the way of this because he's in a moment. We're going to get all this. You know, they don't want to interrupt your thing, but they don't realize that you're like, hey, you could take it down until we get to the front, you know?
Yeah, it's really important. And most directors don't do it. And it's a great thing if you're listening out there is like, take your actor's sign, just say, hey, man, you know, all things being equal, this is going to play in such and such a shot, and we're not doing it till after lunch.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Great. Just know it. Because it's like, you know, I always feel it this way with stunts. You know, it's such a funny thing. Whenever people are too excited to do stunts, I'm like, oh, God, someone's going to get injured, right? Because it's like, we're going to go for it.
Yeah.
And I had an interesting interaction with an actor, and I won't name the actor's name, but, you know, I knew something was wrong when he said to me, he's like, you know, back when I was doing my show, I didn't ever use a stunt guy. I just would do it myself. And I was like, okay, my alarm bells are going off. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get hit. And like, because stuntman's not going to say, hey, you actually punched me in the nose. You know, he thinks, oh, I'm doing this thing. And once I heard him say, I didn't use stuntman, I was like, get ready to get your butt kicked. And we were doing this scene that we were on wires for. And we're fighting in this like zero G thing. And Robbie kicked the shit out of me. And I didn't know what to say or do because you're also like, okay, all right, I'll do it too. You know, because you don't want to complain. But then I'm like, it was such an uncomfortable moment. And maybe this is like, maybe I should say, oh, you know, but you don't want to be seen in this way, like, oh, he hurt me.
I got hurt by him.
Yeah. But it was, I got punched so bad. And the other time I really got hurt in stunts was on The League when our regular stuntman got sick. They brought in this guy I know that you know it, but if you're listening, you may not know this. Like, there are certain stunt directors or people who like run a stunt team that work with stuntmen. And then there are some that work better with actors. And then there's a rare example of people who can work really well with both, right? And, you know, and so this guy was more of the guy who worked very well with stuntmen. So the scene was like, I got hit over the head and I get people kicking me on the ground. Now I'm wearing a gator back, which protects my back, which wasn't really important because I was on my stomach. And what he forgot to tell all the actors in the scene was, pretend to kick him, just kick the ground. Don't kick him in the ribs. All my actors thought I had like some sort of protection on my ribs.
Right.
So they're just pounding my ribs. Oh. And it was, and I was like, stop, not like it. But after like 30 seconds of just getting cracked in the ribs, I was like, oh, I'm done for. Like I was done. Like just, and it was like, oh yeah. No, you're not supposed to kick him. It's like now.
Now you tell, it's always those little tiny miscommunications. I have a theory that the smaller the stunt, the more likely it is to go wrong.
Yes, you're totally right.
So I don't do any stunt at the end of the day, ever. I don't care what it is. No. If it's the end of the day, I'm not doing it. And I don't do stunts before lunch. I don't do a stunt any time that someone is watching the clock, ever.
That's a really good thing because I feel like... And you learn this when you work with certain people. I did a movie with Ving Rhames, and I was like, oh, I'm going to get in front of this thing. And it was like they were firing a cannon full of debris, but it was like soft debris. And Ving grabbed me by the arm, and he says, like, don't get anywhere near that cannon. And I was like, what? And he's like, run as far as you can. He's like, you don't know how fast that stuff is coming out there. He's like, get out of there. And he was so right because that cannon went off. And it came out with such force that it overshot us and landed in the parking lot. So if it was pointed at us, we would have been destroyed. No matter how soft it was, destroyed. But when I felt him grab me by the arm and go, get out of here. I was like, right. Because you're thinking like, I'm gonna do it. I'm going to show him. I'm Tom Cruise. Yeah. I'm going to hang on to that plane. It's like, No. Step it back.
Tell me about your memoir.
Yes.
Joyful Recollections of Trauma. It's out May 21st.
Yes, and you can pre-order it now. And as you know, too, it's like pre-ordering is, I guess, the more important thing at this point.
So it is. Pre-order it now. Pre-order it now. Don't wait, people. Come on, now, right now. Type it in.
It's a memoir that really is not technically a Hollywood memoir, but it's really a memoir about being parented and then becoming a parent. You know, I grew up in this interesting situation when I was a kid. My mom and dad got divorced when I was very, very young. And I kind of got brought into this very bizarre world with my mom's my mom's new husband, my stepdad. And it was a real culture shock. We went from, you know, living in this nice suburban house to a house on a dead end block that when I went back and looked at pictures, I was showing it to my wife and she's like, oh, you lived in a trailer park. And I was like, oh, no. And no offense to anybody there, but I was like, oh, I had a barn and horses in my backyard. And that sounds like, oh, you lived on a ranch. No, I lived on a suburban block on Long Island. We had birds. We were killing birds. I had my stepfather was a truck driver. And there's a lot of things I was kind of exposed to in that world. And I think as I got older, I kind of started to reckon with it as I became a dad. And so the book is really about
reckoning with,
you know, some sort of just these traumas of your youth and how you kind of have to make a decision when you become a parent, when you go to the next step to either take them or, you know, reinvent yourself or try to break free of those things. So, you know, that doesn't sound funny. There's a lot of funny stories in there as well. But you know, it is really kind of a journey about fatherhood and or parenthood, I should say. And then there's a bunch of fun little anecdotes in there as well.
That sounds amazing. I felt like you were telling my story. Divorce, young, screwed. Yeah. It really fucks you up. At least it fucked me up.
Yeah.
Went from Ohio to Malibu, culture shock. And I'm getting, this one is one I'm getting because that's, you know, and you live through it, like you live through it and you think, oh no, this is perfectly normal.
Right.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, sure, whatever. And then you have your own kids and you go, wait one second. So I remember when I was my son or daughter's age, this is what was happening to me. What the hell was everybody thinking?
That's the thing. It's like, I looked at my life in a very interesting way after I had kids. Because all of a sudden, like, once you have kids, those things that you, like, let fly, like, wait, how did, no one did that? Wait, I just, like, I have a story in there about, like, a home invasion that happened to me when I was a kid. Like, this guy came to collect money from my stepfather and tried to break into our house. And this is years before Home Alone. And I had to fend off this giant man who at one point broke through our window and is climbing through our, like, laundry room window trying to get into our house. And I was all home alone. And I, you know, when and the cops came and it was a whole scene. And at the end of it, you know, I was saying to my mom and this man that she was married to, I was like, it was so scary. And they're like, well, you're fine though. It's okay. You're fine. You're not hurt. And it was like, and I was like, oh yeah, I guess I'm fine. And then like, years later, I'm like, that's a trauma that,
yes,
that no one ever wanted to deal with. Like, that, like no one ever talked. Like, it wasn't like there was no talking about it. It was like, you're fine.
No, there
you're
was
fine.
No talking about it. None. And you go, and I don't know about, do you have brothers or sisters?
I don't. I'm an only child.
Oh, see.
So that even makes it a little bit trickier, too. I don't
really
have anybody
tricky
to even bounce it off of. Yeah.
Because my brother and I go, hey, am I insane? Or do you remember the time? And then we both put something together that at the
yes
time we didn't notice. And now we realize was absolutely bananas.
Well, that's, I think the hardest part about writing this book was going, am I insane?
Yes,
am
exactly.
I'm remembering these things. And, you know, it's like, these are stories that were there. And I think the reason why I wrote this book was because I would tell these stories on How Did This Get Made. They would come out like kind of organically. And I would say them just like, oh yeah, well, there was this one time when blah, blah, blah. And Jason and June would look at me like, what? And the audience would be like, wait a second. And I would be like, oh, right. That's odd. Like, you know, like I talk about, you know, it's like all these things that you, until they're put in front of a public, you know, a forum, do you realize like, oh, because you just assume like, that's the life I live. That's all it is. And I'm fine. And here I am. And that's all. No woe is me. But there are these moments that you deal with. And I think especially as I now see certain things through the eyes of my kids, I'm like, I gotta get on this. I mean, and something even small, I mean, it's silly, but I didn't want to go skiing when I was a kid. So I remember a lot of the times my parents would just go like, all right, you just stay here. And I would sit in a ski lodge. My parents would ski 8 hours a day.
Hey, I did the same thing. I remember falling asleep in the underneath the cafeteria tables while my dad would ski all day long.
And it's like, when would you ever leave your child? Like, just go, yep, you're fine. See ya. No check-in, no anything.
We might have had the same childhood.
I know, it seems like it. I mean, that's why probably I loved your book so much.
Yeah, you must have related, because you must have totally
I did,
related.
Yeah. I love it. It's one of my, there are certain books I love to read. There's certain books I love to hear. I love your voice. I love the way you read that book. And it was like, it was one of, I read a book I highly recommend to so many people. It's great. You know, it's.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love it.
Thank you. And thank you for coming on. This is great. I mean, we just missed each other on Parks and Rec. You were on a little bit before my
yes
tenure. That would have been fun.
I know. I was the one who cleared. I basically started the new Parks and Rec. We closed the pit. I was like a season 2,
God,
episode 1. I was like, and the pit is closed. And now we go forward.
It's the pit. One of the great storytelling boondoggles of all time. When I started the Parks and Recollection, and they would keep talking about the pit, I was like, guys, I wasn't there. I never got it. I never understood it. I don't know what the hell they were thinking, but boy, am I glad they finally got rid of it.
It's such a it's a funny idea in theory. There's
yes
a giant pit.
Yeah.
And then it was like, yeah, we don't need, yeah, we got to get past the pit.
Amazing.
But well, it's great. Well, Rob, it was a pleasure. Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. This is amazing. So great.
So
thank you. Like I said, I love having the funny people on. I really, really do. I mean, I just follow them into random rabbit holes. I hope it doesn't try your patience. Because it makes me laugh. That's all I know. And I'm really glad that you are here with us for this one. And we will be back next week with a brand new Literally.
You've been listening to Literally with Rob Lowe, produced by me, Sean Doherty, with help from associate producer Sarah Begar and research by Alyssa Growl. Engineering and mixing by Joanna Samuel. Our executive producers are Rob Lowe for Low Profile, Nick Liao, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross for Team Coco, and Colin Anderson for Stitcher. Booking by Deirdre Dodd. Music by Devin Bryant. Special thanks to Hidden City Studios. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Literally.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.